This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قُلْ إِن تُخْفُوا مَا فِي صُدُورِكُمْ أَوْ تُبْدُوهُ يَعْلَمْهُ اللَّهُ وَيَعْلَمُ مَا فِي السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Look at our top stories this hour. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, tells the visiting Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro that Iran and Venezuela's experience shows that resistance is the path to victory against the U.S. pressure. Intense fighting is underway between Russia and Ukraine in Severodonetsk in the eastern Donbass region, as Kiev says it remains in control of the city's chemical plant. Also, people hold nationwide rallies in the U.S. to push lawmakers to take action on gun violence in the wake of recent mass shooting across the country. Hello and welcome to your world news. It's good to have you with us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says experience shows that resistance is the only path to victory against the pressure campaigns. In a meeting with the Venezuelan president, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Iran and Venezuela have managed to defeat the U.S. hybrid warfare. The leader said Washington imposed the most severe sanctions on Tehran under the so-called maximum pressure campaign, but Iran managed to defuse the U.S. plot through resistance. Ayatollah Khamenei welcomed the signing of a 20-year cooperation agreement between Iran and Venezuela, urging efforts to implement the agreement. The leader said Iran has proved it doesn't shy away from helping its friends when they are in danger. The Venezuelan president thanked Iran for its support for Caracas in its hard fight against the U.S. Nicolas Maduro said Tehran helped Caracas get out of a very difficult situation at a time when no other country supported the Latin American nation. He said Venezuela managed to resist a multidimensional U.S. war, and it's now better off compared to several years ago. Iran and Venezuela have signed a 20-year cooperation document. The document, which focuses on petrochemical, oil, economic, tourism, cultural, and political cooperation, has been signed during a two-day official visit to Tehran by Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro. Salman Kujuri has more.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his visiting Venezuelan counterpart Nicolas Maduro have signed a 20-year document on comprehensive strategic cooperation, which mainly covers a wide range of areas including petrochemical, oil, economic, tourism, cultural and political fields. In a press briefing after the signing ceremony, President Raisi and his Venezuelan counterpart Maduro said the two countries should work together closely in areas such as trade, economy, agriculture, as well as science and technology. technology. They also hailed establishment of direct Tehran-Caracas flights as an opportunity to enhance relations and bring the two nations closer.
Venezuela has shown that it has put up exemplary resistance against the enemy's threats, sanctions, and imperialism. The Iranian nation, too, has been under numerous sanctions and threats for more than 40 years now. But the Iranian people have turned these sanctions into an opportunity to further make progress.
We will witness how the new world will take shape and how we will stand up to problems and secure progress. Iranian and Venezuelan youth should know that the future world will enjoy equality and justice, and that we will stand up to imperialism.
Earlier on Friday, in an interview with Iran's Spanish TV channel Hispan TV, Maduro said Venezuela and Iran are on the front line of shaping a world free of imperialism and dominant powers. Maduro also hailed Iran's courageous move to send fuel tankers to his energy-hungry nation, saying Tehran's delivery of oil to Caracas was a great help to the Venezuelan people.
Now the relations between the two countries are in the best condition, and with the signing of the comprehensive roadmap of cooperation between the two countries, the path of deepening bilateral cooperation will be broadened more than before. We hope that with this increase of contacts and exchanges of visits in the future, the ground for implementing the 20-year document will be provided.
Heading a high-ranking political-economic delegation, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro arrived in Tehran on a two-day state visit at the invitation of Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi. This is his second visit to Tehran. The first one took place about 6 years ago.
Both Iran and Venezuela have managed to withstand the economic pressures from the United States and have closely cooperated to offset the impact of the illegal sanctions, especially in their energy sectors. Saman Kujirip, Tehran.
Political analyst Mustafa Khoshesh explains how the close cooperation between Iran and Venezuela is helping them overcome their problems. Let's take a listen.
Iran rushed to Maduro's help and the Venezuelan people's help. The people were queuing lines, waiting to fill their tanks, car tanks. And Iran sent a dozen tankers, not only taking petrol to Venezuela, but also spare parts for refineries, engineers, technology, and everything, as well as additives and to help the country come back online, bring their refineries back online. And that soothed, actually, the crisis in the country and defused the U.S. plans for overthrowing the government in there. So the two are also major oil-producing countries and could help each other with, managing the global oil market as we are approaching winter. And then the energy prices are rising because of the Ukraine war, and the U.S. needs much energy import as well as the Europeans, and they need energy. And the only two countries that might increase supplies in the market and have reserves are Venezuela and Iran. So they could play a major role in coming months with regard to energy market.
Iran's foreign minister censures the U.S. and its three European allies for submitting an anti-Tehran resolution to the IAEA's Board of Governors. He says the move was politically motivated. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone conversation with U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres. The U.N. chief played down the seriousness of the resolution, describing it as a recommendation. He stressed the need for a continuation of the Vienna talks. Guterres said diplomacy is the best path to tackle differences between Iran and some other parties to the JCPOA. The resolution passed on Wednesday accuses Tehran of inadequate cooperation with the IAEA. Iran has dismissed the allegation, vowing proper reaction and saying those who submitted the resolution put their agenda ahead of the agency's credibility.
Hey everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. Today we're taking a look at the latest anti-Iran resolution by the International Atomic Energy Agency, as well as Tehran's response to it, as well as social media's response to it. Stay tuned. Iran's response to the IAEA resolution, which Tehran describes as politicized, was swift and decisive. It began injecting uranium gas into advanced centrifuges and also disconnected some of the agency's cameras monitoring its sites outside of the safeguards agreement. The IAEA decision to adopt the Israeli-backed resolution, which was put forth by the US, Britain, France, and Germany, sparked a wave of reactions among social media users who see the agency not as an independent watchdog, but as a political instrument. Our first tweet of the day comes from Hossein Mizan. Firstly, IAEA must change its political approach. The U.S. has a way out of the crisis it has created. Give adequate assurances in case it pulls out of the deal again and deal with the sanctions list. Iran won't allow the U.S. or the EU to use the IAEA as a tool. The choice is theirs. Nakwadria has our next tweet. We see the result of Trump's disastrous policy to pull us out of the deal with Iran and the Biden administration's foreign policy failure in not finding a way to return to it. And over here, Sayed Mohammad Marandi has our next tweet. The IAEA chief visited Israeli regime leaders after they murdered Iranians. He had friendly talks even though the regime has secret nuclear facilities and nuclear weapons. He held talks immediately prior to the IAEA board's meeting. U.S. and or the EU aren't ready for a deal, so Iran will retaliate. Many are urging Iran not to bow to pressure and to safeguard its inherent rights to pursue a peaceful nuclear program. They put the blame on the United States for violating the 2015 Iran deal and withdrawing from it unilaterally. Our next batch of comments starts with a tweet by M. Rezaei. Iranians want to withdraw from NPT. Why? Because the IAEA is politicized. The IAEA implements U.S. and Israeli orders and is not independent. Mohammad Saidi has our next tweet. The U.S. has violated its obligation and unilaterally exited from the agreement. Iran will safeguard its inherent right by pursuing a peaceful nuclear program under NPT. The IAEA organization has proven to be an instrument of bias and extremely one-sided. Sasan Urdibehesht said Iran must pursue her independent policy on nuclear energy within the NPT based on Iran's scientific or research and development or energy needs. Negotiating on Iran's God-given rights is the most stupid policy conceivable, keeping Iran eternally in her present defensive position. Throw JCPOA into the dustbin. Elhan Imami said the IAEA is showing that it wasn't established to safeguard nuclear facilities, but to be a pressuring tool for the powerful to keep the weak at bay. Iran is being sacrificed as an example to others to not question or protest these unjust neglects of rights. Meanwhile, the IAEA is also under fire for being disproportionately focused on Iran's nuclear program while neglecting Israel, which is one of the biggest violators of peaceful nuclear technology and has hundreds of nuclear warheads. Our next and final batch of comments starts with a tweet by Manuel J. Castillo. The IAEA should inspect Israel's nuclear stockpile, not Iran. According to ex-President Jimmy Carter, Israel possesses 200 nuclear missiles. Besides, I wonder why Israel not signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the ICC. Iran has the rights to develop its nuclear capability openly. True Democracy tweeted, the IAEA has been politicized. You know something is wrong when the head of an international organization designed to secure the peaceful use of nuclear technology meets with Israelis, the biggest violators of peaceful nuclear technology. Iran must leave the NPT immediately. Drumabella said that the IAEA is being used by the U.S. and European countries to be disproportionately focused on the nuclear energy program in Iran. Why? The U.S. has made a commitment to maintain Israel's qualitative military edge, QME. It's the policy of the USA. The IAEA is a means to this end. And our final comment comes from Taha Khorasani. The issue is not nuclear energy. The issue is that the United States wants to limit everything and do nothing in return. The IAEA is a toy. Otherwise, the IAEA would have approved Iran's nuclear program for years, but Trump withdrew. That'll do it for another edition of Hashtag Trending. Take care and bye-bye.
Welcome back. Russian and Ukrainian forces are locked in an intense battle in the city of Severodonetsk, one of the Ukraine's last holdouts in the eastern Donbass region. Kiev says it remains in control of a chemical plant there, where hundreds of civilians have taken shelter. According to Ukrainian officials, some 800 people are hiding underneath the Azot plant. A pro-Russia representative of the Luhansk region, however, says about 400 Ukrainian troops are holed up there. The official added that those fighters are trying to negotiate their way out of the city, adding that such demands are unacceptable. Elsewhere, Kiev has reported the death of 24 more children in the southeastern city of Mariupol, which was captured by Russia in mid-May. Mariupol's mayor has reported cases of cholera and other infectious diseases there, calling for more humanitarian aid. Meanwhile, Moscow says its air defense forces have shot down three Ukrainian warplanes in southern and northeastern Ukraine. This is while Kiev is asking the West for more advanced weapons. Russia's warning of responding proportionally to a buildup of NATO forces. This after several Eastern European countries called on NATO to strengthen its eastern flank over the war in Ukraine. Russia's foreign ministry says Moscow's response will be appropriate and proportionate. The ministry added such a response will intend to neutralize potential threats to the security of Russia. Moscow was responding to a call from nine European countries, including Poland, who asked the U.S.-led military alliance to consolidate military power along its eastern regions. Last month, NATO announced it was no longer bound by past commitments to hold back from sending forces in Eastern Europe, citing Russia's attack on Ukraine. Thousands of Americans hold nationwide protests to demand tighter gun control laws amid a spate of mass shootings in the United States.
Everyday shootings are everyday problems.
The protests were held in Austin, New York, Washington, D.C., and other U.S. cities. The rallies were organized by March for Our Lives, created by the survivors of the high school mass shooting in Parkland, Florida, in 2018. The activists are calling for restrictions on assault rifles or an outright ban on them. Many deadly mass shootings, including the most recent one in Uvalde, Texas, that killed 19 elementary school students, have been carried out using an assault rifle. According to Gun Violence Archive, firearms have killed over 19,030 people in the U.S. so far this year. 20 years ago, two 14-year-old South Korean girls were walking to their friend's birthday party when they were ran over and killed by a U.S. military vehicle. Saturday, thousands rallied to mark their tragic deaths and called for a change in U.S.-South Korea relations. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
Thousands of South Koreans gathered in downtown Seoul to remember the tragic deaths of Shin Mi-sun and Shin Hyo-soon, ran over by a U.S. military vehicle on their way to their friend's birthday party on June 13, 2002. The children's family's lawyer hopes for change in U.S. relations and influence on Korea.
The massacre of two middle school students is a symbol of unequal South Korea-U.S. relations. In that regard, I think that the work of candlelight among our people to establish an equal relationship between South Korea and the United States in the future and move toward peaceful reunification of the Korean Peninsula remains unfinished.
Two U.S. soldiers were charged with negligent homicide, but acquitted in a U.S. military court amid anti-American candlelight protests. The deaths of Mi Sun and Hyo Soon under the tracks of a U.S. military vehicle 20 years ago are but one episode of a problematic alliance relationship. From the Status of Forces Agreement to the cost of hosting 28,500 troops in South Korea, alliance ties are a constant source of controversy and debate.
Some argue South Koreans view the presence of U.S. forces as an obstacle, preventing the country from exercising sovereignty.
It's not fit for the global era and very risky for South Korea to cling to a falling sun with the status of American hegemony declining so much. I hope we can establish more neutral diplomacy reflecting our national interests.
New President Yoon Suk-yeol seeks to strengthen the South Korea-U.S. alliance, a shift in policy that worries many South Koreans. Frank Smith, Seoul.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
The Limelight.
Proposed legislation to prohibit Palestinian flags at institutions is part of the Zionist regime's quest to deepen its control over the Arab population. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Amir Makul, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Why is the Israeli regime so afraid of the Palestinian flag? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. In a 63-16 vote, the Zionist regime's Knesset gave initial approval to a bill that would prohibit Palestinian flags from being flown at institutions, proposed by the Likud party and backed by the Zionist regime's prime minister, Naftali Bennett. The bill is a clear demonstration of the regime's weakness in the face of Palestinian solidarity, showing that the fake regime of Israel, more than seven decades since its establishment on the ruins of historic Palestine, is in a state of panic. The vote indicated once again that when the ruling coalition is unable to pass a bill, they resort to the Zionist ultra-right-wing parliamentary opposition. For Arab students to raise the Palestinian flag during demonstrations on the Israeli regime campuses is nothing new. It has long been used as a symbol in popular movements, and it was raised once again on May 29, 2022, in a spontaneous reaction to Al-Quds flag march, which saw tens of thousands of Zionists storm the old city. During the event, marchers hoisting the fake regime of Israel's flag were protected by the Zionist regime's forces who occupied the city. The real challenge was to hoist the Palestinian flag so that it could fly above the sea of blue and white flags of the fabricated regime of Israel. The Zionist regime attaches a special importance to the issue of raising the Palestinian flag in Al-Quds, portraying it as a violation of Israeli regime sovereignty, even though it is an occupying power. It resorts to the Oslo Accords and, in particular, to the Paris Protocol of 1994 to confirm that the Palestinian Authority cannot interfere in internal Israeli regime affairs. The fabricated regime of Israel has thus depicted Al-Quds as an Israeli affair and raising the Palestinian flag as an interference. Last month, to mark the 74th anniversary of Nakba, Palestinian students organized demonstrations on university campuses. At Ben-Gurion University, demonstrators waved Palestinian flags at a university-sanctioned event, sparking a Zionist counter-protest and a complaint from the city's mayor. Right-wing activists also hijacked a Nakba Day demonstration by Arab students at Tel Aviv University, leading to a violent confrontation. While both protests and counter-protests by various groups fall within the acceptable framework of academic freedoms, the matter was not confined to this framework, escalating into a campaign of incitement by the Zionist regime's media and political establishment. The sharp increase in the number of the Zionist regime Jews applying for gun licenses is extremely concerning in the context of this atmosphere of escalating incitement against Palestinian citizens, alongside the delegitimization of their political role. The fabricated regime of Israel is working hard to drop the Palestinian issue from the national agenda, while also stifling its presence on the international agenda through normalization deals that expand the Zionist regime's regional influence and establish security cooperation schemes with neighboring Arab regimes. This is all part of an integrated Israeli regime strategy, wherein the issue of Palestinian flag receives much scrutiny, as it is a fundamental symbol of the Palestinian cause. That is why we are seeing a push to ban the Palestinian flag and why the Zionist regime's police went so far as to attack the pallbearers carrying the coffin of slain Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Aghle last month. The proposed anti-flag legislation is part of the Zionist regime's quest to deepen its occupation and weaken the role of 48 Palestinians, suppressing any links they have with the Palestinian cause. The bill that passed its first reading would outlaw the flying of the flags of an enemy or Palestinian Authority at all state-funded institutions, not just universities. This would strengthen the Zionist regime's control across occupied Palestinian territories and push institutions to self-censor in order to preserve their funding, even though, amid the structural discrimination and racism, Palestinian cultural organizations receive only a fraction of available funding anyway. At the end of the day, the flag battle is not about the flag per se, but about the legitimate existence of Palestinians in their own homeland and the right to use their political voice.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Operation Cyanide, Part 3.
Operation Cyanide. If I heard about it, I heard so.
What was it?
I suggest we stop the interview here. What do you say? Why you want it? I am built so, and I know exactly what I am able to tell you, and I know exactly where I stop. And here I stop.
Why would you not be able to speak about Operation Cyanide?
Signature and loyalty to my country.
On June 8, 1967, news spreads around the world which wasn't easy to believe. Unknown attackers target a U.S. military ship in the Mediterranean Sea. After World War II, This was the first time someone had dared to attack the U.S. military. April 30th, 1945, when an all-out rivalry broke out between the Western Allies and the USSR to conquer Berlin, soldiers of the Red Army reached the heart of Nazi Germany sooner than the Americans. With the fall of the city and Adolf Hitler committing suicide, the flames of the horrendous Second War in Europe burnt out. With all the death and destruction, as World War II was coming to an end, the two powerful conquerors could raise their flags on the mountains of soil and ashes and reorganize world order the way they wanted to. The Eastern powerhouse was the USSR, which had the dream of spreading the ideals of communism and saving the masses of the labor force from the oppression of capitalists. And on the other side, the wealthy Western powerhouse, meaning the U.S., was standing on the principles of using capital to create welfare. The USSR was doing everything in its power to entice the masses toward communist ideals and turn governments into its allies.
About 7:15, the telephone rang. It was the duty officer in the war room. Prime Minister Kosygin's on the hotline. He wishes to speak to the president. So the president came on the line. He said, in effect, "God damn it, Bob, what are you calling me for at this time in the morning?" I said, "Mr. President, Prime Minister Kosygin's on the hotline. How do you wish to respond?"
Johnson didn't want the situation to turn into a military confrontation with the USSR. He immediately sent word to Moscow that with the help of the USSR and the UN, the U.S. will use any means to put an end to the war. The telecommunications officers of the ship were trying their best to transmit news of the attack to the 6th Fleet and ask them for help. But the noise that the attack jets were sending on the Liberty's frequencies to transmit communications prevented the transfer of the messages.
Here's a question I have to ask. Who would know the frequencies other than an ally? And who was the ally in the war? It wasn't Egypt. It was Israel.
In the end, one of the Liberty's transmissions reached the USS America warship, and the commander of the ship issued orders for 2 U.S. fighter jets to take off to defend the Liberty.
First identification was Soviet. I said, "Oh my God." Come closer. I came closer and he identified her as an American ship.
Aside from that, the 5x8-foot American flag, which was flying high above the tallest pole of the ship, didn't leave room for the denial of the American identity of the ship. When the flag of the ship fell due to Israeli rocket attacks, under orders from the ship's commander, Captain McGonagall, another flag, a bigger one, was raised on the ship. Even if the Israelis denied all these, they couldn't claim that they weren't aware that all ships and warships of the U.S. Navy are gray. The next speculation regarding the attack on the Liberty came when, under pressure from the USSR, U.S. forced Israel to accept a UN ceasefire resolution. But Eshkol wanted to attach the Golan Heights to the soil of his country before formally accepting the resolution. And this caused speculations that Israel got rid of the Liberty so it could not inform the U.S. of its advances in the Golan Heights. Of course, The only way the U.S. could have found out about Israel's advance in Syria wasn't only from the Liberty. Aside from that, even if the Liberty were to send word of Israel's mischievous activities to the U.S., Israel's reaction shouldn't have been so harsh to try and sink the ship of its friend and ally with all its members on board, something that could have provoked a military reaction from the U.S. Twenty days after the incident, the committee tasked with investigating the attack on the Liberty prepared a 600-page report and delivered it to the offices of the U.S. Naval Force in Europe. The report did not include that a napalm bomb was used during the attack, and most of the witness testimonies had been left out.
I testified, like I said, for about 2.5-3 hours. I didn't know until, I don't remember, months later, that much of my testimony was never recorded.
After reviewing the report, Rear Admiral Merlin Starling, the U.S. Judge Advocate General of the U.S. Navy, said,
"As you know, it's a voluminous document. And one of the things that I initially had difficulty with, and still do, is the fact that the very first statement of fact that the court arrived at and presented was this: available evidence combines to indicate the attack on Liberty on 8 June was in fact a case of mistaken identity. Now, that is the sort of thing in this record that I found great difficulty in supporting from the evidence that was included."
But the attack was neither a mistake nor an attempt to plug the ears of the U.S. The attack on the Liberty was part of a secret and complicated operation that the CIA and Mossad had planned in total intelligence silence. Communism was spreading exponentially in the Middle East, and the U.S. and Israel had to stop it and also prevent the Arabs in the region from becoming more powerful with the help of the USSR. The Soviets were using cables on the bed of the sea to transfer secret intelligence to the Egyptians. And for the U.S. to know what was going on between the USSR and Egypt, it had to listen in on the intelligence that was being transmitted back and forth. It might have also been doing damage to the cables so that it could cut off the underwater transfer of intelligence between the USSR and Egypt. This is how one of the most complicated covert operations during the Cold War was planned by the U.S. and Israel, the covert operation called Cyanide.
I suggest we stop the interview here. What do you say? Why you want it?
Why would you not be able to speak about Operation Cyanide?
Signature and loyalty to my country.
Is it very sensitive?
I am built so, and I know exactly what I am able to tell you, and I know exactly where I stop. And here I stop.
2 months before the Six-Day War between the Arabs and Israel, on April 23, 1967, three American submarines were tasked with infiltrating Egypt's northern waters in the Mediterranean Sea and find out how the underwater intelligence was being transferred. The USS Truta, USS Amberjack, and USS Requin slowly and silently went toward the Mediterranean to see what was going on down there between the USSR and Egypt in the silence of the waters.
Operation Cyanide was a joint Israeli-American venture using submarines and other covert-type intelligence gathering efforts against the UAR. But that has a logical explanation. The explanation is the UAR was totally Soviet equipped. They had Soviet advisors. So the Soviet Union was our arch enemy at the time. And we're concerned in a volatile Mideast situation with the Soviet problem. We were concerned wherever the Soviets showed up. And they had considerable influence in the United Arab Republic. So there were these joint ventures with Israeli intelligence.
Even though the real battle between the two superpowers was going on underwater in the Mediterranean without the use of weapons, they were actually at war. One wanted to help Egypt and Syria get the upper hand in the Middle East and destroy Israel, and the other was fighting for the victory of Israel and the elimination of Soviet communism in the Middle East. Still, direct military confrontation between the two powerhouses wasn't unexpected at all either. Both the Soviet Union and the United States were looking for an excuse with all their might light the flames of World War III. Because the Middle East was the heart of the world's politics and energy supply, rivalry for superiority in the region was worth any kind of hardship. Operation Cyanide was designed in such a way that after the presence of submarines in Egypt's northern waters, the Liberty would get close to the region as a deceptive operation. This would allow Israel to attack it with its uncolored, unidentified fighter jets and bomb it in such a way that nothing would be left of the ship or its crew. But Israel's unsuccessful attack didn't cause the destruction of the ship. Also, the survival of witnesses, meaning wounded naval officers of the Liberty, Operation Cyanide was a total failure. If Liberty had successfully sunk, then the U.S. could have easily accused Egypt for the attack. Then it could attack Egypt and push Nasser out of power and chop down the sapling of communism in the Middle East. But when Israel failed in sinking the ship, McNamara was forced to recall the planes, which had been equipped with nuclear bombs and were en route to Cairo. If nuclear weapons were used against Cairo, the USSR would undoubtedly declare war against the U.S., and a world war would begin so that the horrendous battle of the nuclear powers could decide the fate of the world. The U.S. and USSR were seemingly trying to establish a ceasefire and put an end to the Six-Day War. But in secret, on the battlefield, they were lined up against each other. The USSR had armed Egypt and Syria to the teeth and was helping them with intelligence. And aside from helping arm Israel, the U.S. did something else, too. Israel, which didn't even have a reconnaissance plane, was able to carry out an extremely meticulous identification operation and destroy the naval forces of its three Arab enemies. The extraordinary intelligence help, which turned the tables in favor of Israel, was also part of Operation Cyanide.
There was a hurry-up paint job done to the aircraft to identify them as Israeli aircraft so that they would be in conformance with normal Israeli marking. Take a look at the reconnaissance information that Israelis have. It was published publicly in Time magazine, Life magazine, I think Book magazine. That was our work. The Israelis had no reconnaissance aircraft, and you can't get the detail off of gun cameras that was in those films.
Abdel Nasser knew full well that Israel did not take part in the war without American support. But as he was talking about the same issue with the King of Jordan, he was not aware that the Mossad was listening in on their conversation.
I called up and said, "What is this? There aren't any American aircraft within 300 miles of Egypt." He said, "For your information, they could not possibly have done what they did without help. And that help had to come from you or the British. And we think it was you."
The Six-Day War was over, and Operation Cyanide hadn't achieved all of its goals. The Liberty's wounded crew returned to the U.S. so their country's officials could honor them for surviving the deadly Cyanide operation by chance. The ceremony to award medals always takes place in the White House and by the U.S. President. But Captain McGonagall received his Medal of Honor in an open air in the Naval Sea Systems Command headquarters in Washington, D.C., without media presence from the Defense Secretary, because at the same moment, Johnson was busy handing out diplomas to students in the White House. He had in advance written in McGonagall's award ceremony guidance that due to the sensitive nature of the event, there should be no press coverage of the service.
When I received my Purple Heart in a secret ceremony in the captain's office, I was admonished, threat of court-martial, don't ever tell anyone where you got this. Don't ever tell anyone how you got this medal.
Years later, when the winter of 1998 arrived, Captain McGonagall wrote a letter to President Clinton and asked him to speak about the untold truths of the USS Liberty incident. Before that, a memorial ceremony held in Arlington Cemetery for those who had been killed in the incident, the captain had said that the time had come for the secrets of the Liberty to be revealed.
For many years, I had wanted to believe that the attack on the Liberty was pure error. It appears to me that it was not a pure case of mistaken identity. I think that it's about time that the State of Israel and the United States government provide the crew members of the Liberty and the rest of the American people the facts of what happened and why it came about that the Liberty was attacked 30 years ago today.
But the commander didn't have time to get his answer, and 3 months after writing his letter, he was put to rest in Arlington Cemetery next to the rest of the crew members of the Liberty. The days of the Cold War were passing by, and the cunning Eastern and Western superpowers were battling each other in secret and also openly, making peace, threatening each other, and using 1,001 plots and deceits to perhaps be able to eliminate their tenacious rival. And in the end, it was as if there was no competition or hostility between them. They would sit across from each other and smile diplomatically. Those paying the price for these smiles, conflicts, and complicated games were being paid by innocent people who perhaps had no interest in the games of the powerful or a share of their wins or losses. Their only share from these games was the lives they gave without the right to choose or ask questions so evil forces could set foot on the days left of their lives and climb the ladder of power higher and ever so higher.
In the limelight.
What has emboldened the Tel Aviv regime to accelerate its illegal nuclear activities while wrapping a cloak of secrecy around them is Western sponsorship made possible by Zionist lobbying groups in the United States and Europe. We now present you an article written by Sayed Zafar Mahdi, a Tehran-based journalist, editor and blogger. The piece is titled, How West Helped Israel Take UN Nuclear Agency Hostage. The Zionist regime of Israel initiated its clandestine nuclear program in 1952, with technological support from France and the United States of America, the two countries most vocal about Iran's peaceful civilian nuclear program. According to military think tanks, the first nuclear weapons were developed by the Tel Aviv regime somewhere around 1967-1968. After that, the production accelerated rapidly, with zero international outcry. Today, the Israeli regime possesses over 90 nuclear warheads with enough plutonium to produce at least 200 nuclear weapons. Around 5 kilograms of weapons-grade plutonium is required for one nuclear bomb. Despite its nuclear program being an open secret, thanks to technician Mordechai Vanunu, who blew the lid off Pandora's box back in 1986, the regime has obdurately refused to confirm or deny it. Mordechai Vanunu, who worked at the Dimona nuclear facility, was in 1988 convicted of treason and sentenced to 18 years in prison. The same year, he was also nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Vanunu isn't the only one to blow the whistle. In December of 2013, former Israeli Knesset member Avraham Berg, in a rare admission, said the Israeli regime possessed both nuclear and chemical weapons, dubbing the official policy of nuclear ambiguity as outdated and childish. He was soon reprimanded. What has emboldened Tel Aviv to accelerate its nuclear activities while wrapping a cloak of secrecy around them is Western sponsorship made possible by Zionist lobbying groups in both the United States and Europe. The two countries most critical of Iran's nuclear program are Israel's staunchest allies, who helped the regime become a nuclear-armed entity. Israel's weapons-grade fissile material stocks originated in France in the 1960s, and the United States of America in the late 1960s. With America's support in particular, the Israeli regime has been able to escape accountability for its clandestine, diabolical activities. In a classic case of double standards, successive regimes in Washington have made a conscious effort not to talk about Israel's nuclear arsenal, despite making hullabaloo for non-proliferation in the region. It began back in 1968, when the then CIA director, Richard Helms, informed President Lyndon B. Johnson that the Zionist regime had built nuclear weapons and that its Air Force had conducted aerial maneuvers to drop them. Lyndon B. Johnson's response on expected lines was muted. Just a year later, at a meeting between just-elected President Richard Nixon and then-Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir, it was agreed that Washington will not force Israel to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, which had opened for signature months before, in July of 1968. The U.S. policy of silence continued, which helped the illegitimate regime in Tel Aviv escape the scrutiny of the United Nations nuclear watchdog, the IAEA. This silence amounted to both cowardice and complicity. Importantly, and quite scandalously, Israel is not the signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT. It has repeatedly rejected calls to join the Keystone Accord of the International Arms Control Regime and refused to give United Nations Nuclear Agency, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA's inspectors, access to its clandestine nuclear sites. Despite the Israeli regime's dismissive approach, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has adopted a remarkably soft approach, to the point that many see collusion between the two. IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi's whirlwind trip to Tel Aviv ahead of the recent UN Nuclear Agency's Board of Governors meeting in Vienna lent credence to the plausible Israeli IAEA collusion theory. Rafael Grossi dashed off to the occupied Palestinian territories to discuss the anti-Iran resolution drafted by the United States and the European Troika with Israeli officials, aimed at mounting pressure on Iran to give up its legitimate demands. Does it make sense that the IAEA chief meets the head of an illegitimate regime which has secretly built a nuclear arsenal and refused to cooperate with the UN agency to discuss the nuclear program of a country that has signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, cooperated fully with the agency and fulfilled all of its obligations? It smells of something deeply sinister and extremely despicable. The resolution against Iran at the IAEA Board of Governors meeting, which has already seen a firm and proportionate response from Tehran, blamed Iran for lack of cooperation with the UN agency. For those unnerved by Iran's decision to ramp up its nuclear enrichment capacity, it is essential to understand that the Islamic Republic claims its rights under the Article 4 of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, to pursue a peaceful civilian nuclear program for energy purposes, unlike rogue regimes like Israel. It's also imperative to understand the decision to scale up uranium enrichment from 3.65% stipulated in the 2015 nuclear deal came a year after former US President Donald Trump, in a unilateral and illegal move, pulled out his country out of the landmark agreement, followed by reinstatement of sanctions against Iran. The negotiations between Iran and the so-called world powers to salvage the deal have been paused, not because of Iran's excessive demands or non-compliance, but because of West obstructionism. Iran did everything to save the deal, but the other parties continued to make all-out effort to kill the same deal. The latest move to remove cameras operating beyond the NPT safeguards agreement